Another myth is this concept that you need to wait until the person hits some mythic point of devastation or a bottom.
Right.
In other words, that they're ready for motivation, are ready to change. And that's not true. Okay, mm-hmm. That's kind of an antiquated notion.
Welcome to the Four Peaks Parents Podcast with Thomas Miller. Are you tired of your tweens, teens, and young adults' negative behaviors and poor choices holding you emotionally hostage, controlling your family, and ruling your life? If you answered yes, then you are in the right place. This podcast is a community for courageous parents just like you who come here to gain effective tools, skills, and take action so they can change their tween, teen, or young adult's life and improve their family's future. Welcome to the Four Peaks Parents Podcast with your host, Thomas Miller. Super excited to have with me today Brad Warner, who is an interventionist and has been doing this work, oh my God, for 30 years. He's an interventionist, a therapist. He brings love and passion and tons and tons of experience to his work. He does interventions in the U.S., out of the country. He has fantastic affiliations and relationships with so many wonderful treatment centers throughout the country. He works with people of all ages, all addictions and mental health disorders, you name it, he's done it. And he has been a really great colleague of mine and has absolutely worked with me to collaborate to support some of the families that I've been working with and coaching through the Four Peaks Parents Program. So we're super happy to have Brad. Welcome, Brad, to the show.
Hello, Thomas. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. Awesome. So as you know, we always do whenever we have a guest, we're always trying to expand our audience's knowledge so that they can be that much more resourced and tooled and obviously be more effective at managing the family culture. I talk a lot about the family culture. So just to kind of start broad, because I think most people probably have an understanding of what an interventionist is, but I'm sure you're often dispelling myths and rumors or misunderstandings. But if you could just kind of share for the audience a little bit about, in general, what the heck do you do?
Well, you know, intervention is, I guess in the most classical sense, you would say intervention is a planned meeting with a person with a mental health or addiction issue or family issue, usually all three of those things. The objective of this, the intervention typically is to get the person into treatment, but more globally to make a change in the family system or family culture. Mm-hmm. I like the word culture too. That's a good one. So really that can manifest itself many different ways as far as what the meeting looks like. It could be on Zoom. It could be just a conversation over time with the family consulting. It could be a meeting with the family individually and then, or a meeting with the family and then individually bring the person in. Or it could be a classic Johnson intervention, which a good proportion of the ones I do turn out to be or often end up as. Which is, you know, more of a surprise kind of meeting with the person or one that's, and typically those meetings occur when we can't get the person to a meeting. Mm-hmm. They're not reliable or they're just not capable of showing up or they're refusing. So we bring the meeting to them, as it were. But we, you know, and the hallmark of a good intervention in my mind also is one that has two things. I mean, love and the truth. If you really want to break it to a sit down to its most simple elements, it has to be a loving tone. Mm-hmm. With the person, and in spite of whatever tone they may adapt. Mm-hmm. I might add, and there has to be honesty. But you know, a wise man once told me, honesty without love is brutality.
Sure. Sure.
So a lot of what I'm doing with families are coaching them on psychoeducational issue of like what addiction or mental health looks like or what family systems in maybe a more healthy permutation might look like. Doing some education, doing some coaching, doing some just connecting with them on a basic level. So, and then trying to get the family to a healthier place.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah. And the thing I love about Brad, having worked, you know, with Brad, and I've actually known you now for about a decade, which is pretty crazy, is that you spoke about loving, right? You spoke about engagement. You spoke about rapport building, relationship building. You do such a wonderful job of that. And I think that's why we work really well together, is that, you know, there's so much touch points that often I've put in when I'm working with these families to build that trust, build that rapport, that when I'm turning to you, because if you think of a Johnson, like you said, intervention where the loved one is, it's a surprise, you know, the family is the one that now is finally ready. And more often than not, there was a lot of resistance on the front end, even on the family side. And then eventually there was a lot of prep work. And I love that you spoke that it's not only about the surprise, if you will, intervention, but that you're starting a lot, you know, way back, you know, on really trying to build that relationship and engage that person around, you know, what does recovery, what does, you know, support look like for them? What are some myths and, you know, that you tend to encounter and have to probably educate people on the front end about what you do, so you're not, you know, showing up at some van and grabbing somebody and throwing them in your van with the mushroom window and driving off into the sunset, which Brad does not have the van, nor does he have the mushroom window. But what I'm sure you're dealing with a lot of that. I'm sure you're dealing with a lot of misunderstandings. And what are some real common kind of myths or erroneous thinking that you have to address on the front end, either with the family or with the person or just with society in general?
Well, okay. So we kind of addressed one earlier, that the concept that the intervention is just for the specific person with the problem, with the identified person. I mean, I consider intervention where there hasn't been some sort of change in the family dynamic. If I haven't done that, then that I've somewhat failed. Mm-hmm. Or at least not achieve my objective, what I'd like to do, and which sometimes happens. I mean, when you're dealing with the family system, you're dealing with a lot of history and a whole series of relationships that make up that family culture, and it takes time to make some changes. Now, the other piece is that families arrive at my doorstep or your doorstep. You do a lot of this same kind of thing, but they arrive at different levels of motivation and readiness for change. So some of the issues, just getting them to understand that what I say is a rising ocean lifts all boats, that when a family changes writ large, it really will help the person that everyone's worried about immensely. That's a key piece. Now, another myth is this concept that you need to wait until the person hits some mythic point of devastation or a bottom.
Right.
In other words, that they're ready for motivation, are ready to change. And that's not true. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an antiquated notion. You know, the more we've learned about stages of change, for instance, that we know that you can affect in a person's motivation. Over the years, you know, I can't even count how many people I brought to treatment who had an absolutely zilch desire to change and who are doing very well right now.
100%.
And we're embarked on that process. We're trying to basically, in the intervention, lift the bottom up to hit them before they go back down any further, and to kind of circumvent future pain. You know, that's another one that somehow you have to hit a bottom.
And I think one thing that you know so well, unfortunately, and we all do in this field, is that this is a potentially fatal disease, right?
Yes.
We're talking about addiction, right? It's the beauty of this work. And I have a lot of friends who are not in the space, who are therapists and do more mental health work, and they do great stuff. But they're always talking to me like, Why do you do addiction stuff, you know? And I always say, number one, I love the underdog, and I love that it's treatable, right? There's so many diseases that are chronic, like addiction is, and are not treatable. you know, we can split hairs on is this curable or not, but the reality is that we know addiction is treatable. And there's such a great opportunity there. And I think you, I'm sure, like you're just saying, to wait until someone has that eventual, right, wake-up call, like you said, they don't really know what their rock bottom is because they have a shovel in their hand, right? Mm-hmm. And we're dealing with a potentially fatal disease. And I think that's such an important point, that to wait for that aha moment that may never come, which is why, of course, I'm doing the work I'm doing to stimulate, right, the change agent being the family and or the parents. And like, you know, this is a family illness that affects everyone, and everyone is playing a role unconsciously or unwittingly. And so, you know, I'm always trying on the front end to, right, begin to create a positive parallel process of getting this family to take a look at themselves and shift their dynamics and what they're asking of themselves, in the hopes, of course, that if this loved one is ready for said intervention or change, that the twains shall meet, right? That I want mm-hmm. that family as healthy as possible. I think that's super important. Where do you find the most sort of resistance? Who do you find is potentially, for lack of a better word, more problematic in the process? You know, are you seeing more resistance on the family side? Are you seeing more resistance on the client side? Is it sort of both? Is it ultimately so individualized? And how do you work with that?
I think that's a great question. Classically, I would say, or historically, I think probably the families have the harder time mm-hmm. in initially, although some families come to me and they're completely ready to do whatever it takes. And other families come and they think they are, but they're not fully there yet. And the family members oftentimes, you know, they on the outside look like they're functioning well, and they may not, you know, they're not doing what the other person with the mental health addiction problem are doing. So it's easy for them to feel like they're not part of the problem. And part of the problem, you know, for a lot of families, I mean, it's so normal to enable mm-hmm. a loved one. I mean, mm-hmm. it's the most normal thing. There's nobody that ever hasn't done it, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If they have a family member that's in trouble, mm-hmm. it's a Darwinian thing, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You're trying to, you see someone you love that's in trouble and possibly, you know, existentially in trouble. You try to save them. You try to do something to mitigate these problems. And, you know, the problem is that if you're, you know, how I define it, kind of a codependent relationship is if I'm not helping them and I'm not helping me, then I'm not helping, you know, that. So trying to get people that kind of to change the way they're helping, basically, and that it's, you know, that the most basic thing is that, you know, you can love someone by saying yes, and you can love them by saying no. Mm. No is a very loving word. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the other thing, they're often dealing with someone who's in a defensive crouch and mm-hmm. and is pushing back mm-hmm. and angry. And it's hard for them to deal with those sets of behaviors. So it's easier to do something that's going to placate the person rather than something that's going to harsh their mellow, shall we say.
I was going to say, there's so much wisdom in what you just said, this idea of changing the way someone's trying to help. And I love, again, having worked with you, the thing that you do so well is I think you disarm a lot of the families, I think, initial perceptions of either who you will be or who they will have to become. And you do such a nice job of always maintaining a strength-based perspective and lens. And I think that piece around loving someone is saying yes and saying no. It's holding, right, space for all kinds of different tools and approaches, from boundaries to limits to, of course, support to, of course. And I think what kills me in the industry sometimes, I hear, you know, these of course catchphrases like, you know, we don't believe in detaching with love, that's terrible, or we do an invitation to change, that's our approach, or we do heart-centered, or we do trauma-informed, or we do. And at the end of the day, I think it really doesn't help families, because it's obviously some person trying to, you know, I think, be disruptive in the space and kind of distill down into some nice little words. But the reality is, you do all of those things. And when I just heard Dr. Temple Grandin the other day at High Watch, she said, you should affirm, not accommodate your child. She's talking about neurodivergent children and just children in general. And I love that. And I think you do a wonderful job of helping the families realize that this is a way for them to affirm, right? And actually create a process that allows their child to step into the highest possibility of who they can be. And you do that really well, like really well. And there's so much fear. I mean, so how do you dispel that fear and turn their fear into interest in this process? Because I'm sure on the front end, fear is probably really driving the hell out of their resistance, right? That defensive crouch that you spoke to.
Mm-hmm.
How do you do that?
Well, one thing I tell families right off is, listen, I don't have any kind of like magic wand that's going to, you know, get the person to treatment and get them motivated. You know, we're going to work as a team. And the first thing is joining with them and kind of going to where they're at, understanding where they're at. And in order to do that, now it's taken me a long time to understand, like, why do I even do this work? Like, what? And when I was a kid, my family was, you know, Hall of Fame dysfunctional family. You know, we were right up there. But my father died when I was a kid, when I was young. Mm-hmm. And my mother, and I have like a bunch of sisters, like five sisters. But one of the things that I only in retrospect, I figured out about me is that from an early age, I wanted to get out of my family. So I started to join with other families, friends of mine's families. Mm-hmm. And I would be able to integrate. And part of this was developing kind of chameleon behaviors. And part of this was dysfunctional, if you will. But however, it was also out of a need to find families that were functioning better. And also I wanted out. So it took me years of doing this. And I thought, you know what? I think that's part of where I got that strength and why I like it. I'm fascinated by families.
As am I.
And the way families operate. Mm-hmm. And I think that if you don't have, you know, when I lose my curiosity about families, I'm not going to be doing this work, any work with families anymore. And because I was trained as a family therapist, but really I got training from childhood.
Sure.
and also I had also, you know, been kind of like my mother's therapist. With her grief and all of her problems that she had, mental health issues and whatnot. So
you couldn't bill for those early sessions, unfortunately, though.
That's right. Why did? Yeah. No, I didn't. No, I didn't. I did not get paid on that. So, you know, I think the first thing is that you've got to kind of like figure out what's going on with the family. And in order to do that, you kind of have to talk their language too.
Mm.
And you can't talk, you know, a clinical language necessarily. Mm-hmm. You gotta like go to where they're at and really kind of feel what's happening there. So some of it's just like intuitive, but then if they trust you, then you gotta lead them. You can't lead anyone if they don't trust you. You know, and sometimes you know families decide they can't do it. You know, they're not gonna. Or there's a lot of other things. Talking about just other myths, you know, one of them is learned helplessness. I mean, the families, if they're dealing with someone over time, they feel like, okay, what's the use? They're not going to change. So there's no absolutely no use. So the other thing you must interject is hope.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so along with love is hope. His families are feeling, usually when they call me or you, they're usually feeling pretty hopeless about the situation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why would you do anything if you didn't have any kind of hope or light down the end of the tunnel, you know, and knowing that it's not the train coming. The other one is, you know, a person, they think if they do it, the person's going to never love them again, never talk to them again, all that stuff. And so really walking the families through their fears, you know, and, you know, hearing them, but understanding and sharing an experience and you know, experience. And sometimes I will connect them with other families too, to let them know, because they where it felt exactly, they've been through right what they went through. And if they hear it from another family, they go, okay, maybe, you know, Johnny's going to do, you know, get this thing, or maybe it's worth trying. So
that's such a good answer. First off, thank you for being vulnerable and sharing part of your story of your family being a little hall of fame on the hall of fame of dysfunctionality. I think, you know, I look back at myself too, and it is the curiosity. And I think there's something so strength-based about what you said, that you're interested in how this family operates. Because when you really think about it, every family is trying to create homeostasis, right? They're trying to create some sense of semblance, right, of normalcy. And even if that normalcy is dysfunctionality, I always use the analogy of, it's like mercury. When you drop mercury on the floor, it spreads apart and then it comes back together. And so those dynamics, healthy, unhealthy, a blend of the two, because as you know, and I know, right, there is no perfect family. Every family is quote unquote contaminated with, right, goods and bads and everything in between. But I love that that's when you're going to retire. That's really good. I've never heard it that way, but I think I can resonate with that. The moment I stop being interested in seeing, you know, what is this family all about and what are they trying to achieve? And, oh, in their own crazy way, they're trying to create safety, or this is just their best thinking in the moment, or left to their own devices, kind of like that mercury. This is how they operate. And once I think you take that adaptive lens, which you do all the time, again, having seen you work, I think that allows you to get in, right? Because you're looking at it. It's almost like Jane Goodall, right? I imagine her like in the jungle observing, you know, the gorillas, right? She didn't go there with a bias. She went there sort of more neutral. And again, you come at families definitely in non-clinical speak, which I love, which is why I think we work well together. We could talk shop and do tons of psychobabble if we want to. We have that pedigree, but that's not going to help anybody. And you have to, like you said, meet people where they're at and kind of gargle their culture or their worldview. I wonder if you could also speak to, you spoke a little bit about, this person may resent me, and I think that's a defense. I think families often use that to not want to act because they don't want to manage the conflict potentially, and they don't maybe have enough courage within themselves to make this decision. What do you hear, or do you hear? Because I used to hear this all the time in wilderness when I was the clinical director of Adirondack Leadership Expeditions, that the families used to think, is my child going to have a Stockholm syndrome effect, meaning that they're only going to act and purport to look recovered, for lack of a better word, you know, just to kind of get out of the program. And that really is not point, you know, it's all pointless, right? Because in the end, they're just going to revert back. And we know the recidivism of addiction, the return, right? The relapse is so high. So how do you keep families from, like you said, staying hopeful and not being so fatalistic? Without also not saying your loved one in 28 days is going to be cured, because I know it could be another podcast, but we both know the longer someone stays in treatment, right, the longer someone really digs into the work, the greater the outcomes are. And we can rip a new one of many of these programs that promise a bazillion things, right, in 2 to 3 or 4 weeks. So, but how do you keep families kind of buying in and doing the work, you know, and believing in this process?
That's a good question. Part of the way is, you know, they felt most families, you know, when they're dealing with the addiction and mental illness, I mean, you're dealing with, you know, part of the, and this is part of the, I think, a Darwinian thing too, is that you end up retreating and trying to deal with this thing out in a kind of hermetically sealed environment. So you just, and then you have no other support. So to me, it's so important getting other people. Like, I'm doing an intervention tomorrow with someone, and it wasn't until I got the sister helping the parents, the sister, because the sister, again, the sister told me, she goes, something on the nature of, like, you know, 3 years ago, I was, I'm, I was where they're at 3 years ago. So she was already motivated. So, so then how do you integrate other people? How do you integrate other people into the process to support, particularly the parents, you know, in doing the right thing, the hard thing, confronting an issue and with, you know, with solution, not just confronting an issue, you know, with intent and, you know, with direction. For me, an intervention has to have like four kind of dimensions. One, you have to have a group of people, because usually if I just have, you know, and even if I'm doing an invitational model, I want to get those people motivated. And oftentimes, you know, an aunt or, you know, the grandparent or some other person has a sight line into the person that the parents need to hear.
Sure.
Or can benefit from hearing. So you need a group, and then you need to get treatment, some sort of solution set up. You know, that has to happen. And I help families, you know, figure out where and, you know, and what might work optimally. And, you know, and I also try to help them understand there is no perfect treatment out there.
Sure.
And, you know, let's just try to get for the best we can. The mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, good enough parenting.
100%.
And then the third piece is, you know, getting the family educated and supported and coached to what to say to the person and how to say it. And that, because usually their strategies before have not worked, so they need new strategies. And then the fourth one is to, okay, how to use other leverage, more tangible, transactional levers, fiduciary issues. Just, you know, what are you, this is what we're willing to support, and this is what we're not willing to support. So, and if you give the family, you know, a strategy and then support to do though, to make it happen, they're going to be a lot more, feeling a lot more motivated.
Sure.
And less fearful about doing an intervention, you know, before waiting till it's so bad, you know, where then that's the last thing. And I'm, you know, it's like any disorder. Would you want to intervene at an earlier part of cancer, or would you want to wait till it's like stage four?
Sure.
And I try to get families to understand that too. And part of that is, you know, let's imagine what, you know, if you don't do anything,
sure,
where is this headed? That can be very therapeutic for a family to see, because they, you know, they think it's bad now. You know, let's wait longer.
Yeah. And I, as you know, there's a cost of inaction. And I use that a lot with families, not only financially, right, but medically, right, psychologically. And like you said, since this is a progressive disease, waiting for buy-in that may never, ever come, right? Now we're already dealing with an impaired brain, and now we're going to deal with even more steeped, right, psychopathology on the mental health and or addiction side. And we still have a little bit of time. I just want to give a really big plug, though, to you, Brad, because having worked with you, you do such a wonderful job, as I've already said, building rapport and disarming people. The thing I love, too, about you is that you have these wonderful strategic relationships, you know, and so when families are working with me, it's similar, right? They're buying, of course, my expertise and my tools, and they go through the whole Four Peaks Parents program. They're also, in essence, buying my experience and my network, right? And so you do such a good job. And Brad, you know, you will fly, you will drive, you will take a boat, a train, whatever's necessary, right there on the spot. And you do a really great job behind the scenes, making sure, of course, that the doors to treatment are available. So I want to give you a moment, of course, to just shout out how someone, if they're interested in possibly exploring an intervention with you, if they feel that they even just want to kick that opportunity around with you, how can people reach out to you?
I'll give you my number. You know, most people, they get my number through treatment centers, through therapists I work with, through Thomas, and right back at you, man. The work you do with families is incredible. I mean, you really, when I'm working with a family with you, I know they've brought them far, into, you know, out of the woods, shall we say. But, you know, the main, you know, you can find me on LinkedIn. You can, you can call me, you know.
Yeah. Search Brad Warner on LinkedIn for sure. I got to give a shameless plug for a second. You mentioned bringing in the sister or the aunt or whatever, because the family lacks objectivity. And one of the things I'm really proud of is the Four Peaks program has hit now 2.5 years, but the group model has hit about a year. And so it's really neat to see, of course, families that really want that anonymity will still work with me on an individual basis, which makes sense for them, of course. But I'm really proud of the fact that I've run many families now through the full Four Peaks, the full 90 days. I do pods of four, tops five. So there's a deep level of intimacy there. And like you said, with that sister who kind of has, you know, kind of an outsider's view and is not maybe so close. It's kind of like I use the analogy of when you're standing so close to an elephant, all you see is gray. It's been really nice for other families to hear from another family who's been there, done that, and it creates a sense of universality. So if anyone's interested, of course, in jumping on a discovery call with me, you can go to fourpeaksparents.com, book a free discovery call, and we could see whether or not it makes sense to work together on either an individual or group basis. Please, in the bottom of the description on this show, for anyone listening, of course, sign up for the newsletter where you can get free tips and tools that will write to your inbox that will help you create a positive shift in your family. I want to give you one last question. If you could just give a family one tip or tool today, whether they ever pull a trigger on an intervention or not, what's one thing that you would love families to think about to help move the culture or the dynamics forward when it comes to co-occurring issues of mental health or addiction? Anything you think in your amazing wisdom and experience?
Well, I guess the main thing I would say is everyone's going to be, you know, I'm sober 40 years now myself. Okay. I got sober in my early 20s. And family, I had family members that pushed me forward, you know, you know, Wiseman once told me, as far as addiction was, you know, everyone gets sober. It's nice to be alive when it happens. I was reading the Surgeon General's, in 2016, Surgeon General came out with this thing on addiction. And he said, of all the people who have addiction, only something like 11.9% got treatment.
Wow.
Okay. Which is astounding. If it was cancer or heart disease, sure, people would be up in arms. What the hell?
Yeah.
This is crazy. Well, you know, again, this is because of a lot of things, access to good care. There's a lot of stigma. But there's also denial. And you can't solve a problem that you don't walk through, you face. Okay. Mm-hmm. So have courage, but you don't do it alone. That's what I'd be saying to the families is don't do it alone. Find place like Thomas's group, or, you know, Al-Anon, go to find some way to let other people help you, or it could be another family member. Because the person that has this problem is going to be intervened. They're going to be intervened by the law. They're going to be intervened by, you know, medical people, you know, doing it therapeutically, I think is a softer way of dealing with this, but also I think more effective because, you know, you have a actual solution that we're headed, everyone's rowing towards. So.
Awesome.
Courage.
Awesome. Yeah, I love that.
Have courage.
Courage, action, ask for help. Don't do it yourself. Those are great tips. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. And I hope that the listeners got a lot of value out of this. And again, don't hesitate to reach out to myself or Brad for support. And you can find Brad through LinkedIn. You can absolutely email me and I'll glad to pass his contacts along as well. So thank you so much, Brad. And for anybody, you know, listening, just keep having hope and keep going. Take care and be well. Bye. Hey everyone, Thomas here. First off, it means the world to me that you took the time to listen to my podcast. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Also, If you want to receive the latest podcast updates, as well as expert parenting tips and practical strategies for navigating your tween, teen, or young adult's challenges directly to your inbox, then sign up for my newsletter. The link is in the description. And most importantly, if you're tired of feeling overwhelmed, stuck, stressed, and are losing sleep because you're constantly worried about your tween, teen, or young adult, your first step is to realize that you still have a choice and can do something about it. I'm ready to help you take action and create the results you desire today. Just go to 4peaksparents.com and book a free strategy call. Let's do this. Last thing, while you are listening to this show, who was the one person that you thought could really benefit from hearing it? Please share it with them.
Produced by Audavita Studios. Connect your voice to the world.